the Takeaway Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry in the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. And, you know, we really hope that this radio program has a shot at making it past the end of the world. Civilization, don't you think, will need a pretty big takeaway if for some reason it gets wiped out? And while we understand the fragility of our position in the media and culture, we might not survive the deluge. We are actually wondering this hour, what might survive the end of everything? Now, you're probably wondering to yourself, what is that Hockenberry guy talking about? But down here in Georgia, I'm serious, some folks are way ahead of us. There is a granite monument called the Georgia Guidestones, engraved with messages for future societies in the event of a nuclear attack, built in the 1970s. We're going to talk about that granite takeaway a little later this hour, but hey, anyone can play this ultimate takeaway game, right? What message or lesson would you engrave for future generations?
My name's Amanda. I'm from Gainesville, Florida. Be nice, bathe often, and don't let your kids have candy for breakfast.
Great, Amanda. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE for your post-doomsday message. Wear sunscreen, right? Here's an actual message from the Georgia Guidestones. Avoid petty laws and useless officials. It may be a little late for that. The chance of a showdown over a government shutdown, over raising the federal debt ceiling, and over the funding of the Affordable Care Act, a real showdown is more likely now that the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, has joined the until yesterday rebel faction in the Republican-controlled House to push a deal that is believed to be dead on arrival in the democratically controlled Senate. That's where we begin this hour. The deal cobbles together everything from delaying Obamacare to speeding up the construction of the Keystone Pipeline and overhauling the federal tax code. Todd Zwillick joins us, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So has Boehner given in to what looks like a kind of Tea Party wish list? Has he thrown in the towel, or does he know something we don't?
Well, we have to separate a couple of things and realize that this scenario isn't a whole lot different than what's been going on since 2011. How many times, John, have you and I talked about the Republican establishment, John Boehner, sometimes Mitch McConnell, battling the Tea Partiers, the conservatives, the insurgents, especially in the House? Well, it has come to a head. Let's separate a couple of things. You were just talking about the debt limit and tax reform and Republicans demanding Keystone Pipeline and a one-year delay in Obamacare. That's all true, but that's all coming later. Let's deal with what's happening this very week. How about a government shutdown, where Speaker Boehner has cast his lot in, or so it seems for the moment, with a conservative demand that any effort to fund the government, government funding runs out September 30th, be combined with a full repeal, a defund of Obamacare. And he has tried to sort of finesse this with conservatives to say, we'll give you a vote, but we won't go to the mat on it, and came out of a meeting yesterday, and they've basically combined these two things for a vote tomorrow. But I do want to warn you, because a lot of what you're reading in the paper is getting a little bit hectic about this. It doesn't necessarily increase the chances of a government shutdown next week. It does make that first thing you talked about, a debt limit fight, a little more grave.
Well, let's just sort of characterize the state of the debate on this right now. You're going to hear John Boehner, who came out of that meeting and spoke to the press, and then President Obama speaking to the business roundtable. Let's hear them back to back. First, Speaker Boehner.
Our goal here is to cut spending and to protect the American people from Obamacare. It's as simple as that. There's no interest on our part in shutting the government down.
Doing things in a way that reflect the genuine, messy negotiations of democracy, but do not promise apocalypse every 3 months.
Todd Zwillick, is it just me, but do both of these guys sound tired of this? Both of them.
The president is certainly tired of it. Yeah, they're both tired of this. What the president was talking about in that clip there, John, was negotiating over the debt limit. And this is where it gets a little bit hairy on the debt limit issue. The White House has said, we're not going to continue with this precedent of the routine business of having to raise the federal debt limit to pay obligations that the government has already passed to make it a huge negotiation over opposition demands. No president should have to do that. In fact, the White House is happy to negotiate over debt reduction or replacing the sequester or something like that, spending issues attached to the debt limit. But the president is saying, I won't even have a discussion with you if this one-year delay of Obamacare is in there. Now, before we get to that point, what's going to happen on this government shutdown business? John, tomorrow the House is going to pass a bill that funds the government for a year after September 30th and defunds Obamacare. That bill's going to go to the Senate. The Senate is going to kill it. Harry Reid's going to kill it. The Democrats won't vote for it. Even some of the conservative senators like Ted Cruz have already conceded that they've lost after stirring up the Republicans in the House to do this. And boy, are they mad over in the House that Ted Cruz, they feel like, has already pulled a rug out from under them. So what's going to happen? Harry Reid's going to kill it. And then the Senate is going to send back some form of a continuing resolution to the House that doesn't have a defund of Obamacare. We will probably avoid a government shutdown on that basis. And then we will really worry about this debt limit increase fight. How are Speaker Boehner, the conservatives, and President Obama going to get on the same page? It's unclear.
And we may be talking about these same kinds of concessions once we are faced with the debt ceiling limit, even if we do get past the government shutdown, right?
And that's a potential major problem, because it is not clear where the votes come from to raise the debt limit. If it comes down to the John, to a point, let's all just forget about this fight. We've had our say. Conservatives have had their say. The president's had his say. Let's just raise the debt limit. It's not clear there are the votes in the House for a clean debt limit increase, just a regular old run-of-the-mill debt limit increase. It's not clear they have the votes even for that. So it is unclear what the path is on avoiding a default.
Consumer question before we go, Todd, quickly. So should I postpone my elective surgery that's insured because of the Affordable Care Act missing the October 1st deadline, or what?
Here's the thing about Obamacare. Don't worry about it. Obamacare, if you're a Democrat, is safe. Obamacare, if you're a Republican, is going to happen no matter what you do on October 1st. Obamacare is going nowhere. I would maybe worry about if you have a bunch of T-bills or government bonds in your portfolio. Make sure that those don't lose a great deal of value after October 15th.
Todd Zwillich, thanks for that concrete advice about apocalypse, which we'll be talking about later this hour. Todd Zwillich, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Pleasure, John.
This is The Takeaway. Meanwhile, while Congress tries to make the Affordable Care Act deadline as dramatic as possible, much of the healthcare industry is actually planning for the Affordable Care Act's implementation on October 1st. Walgreens, the retailer and pharmacy, is the latest and largest company yet to revamp their company-backed health program, essentially creating an incentive for their 140,000 workers to join the new Affordable Care Act insurance exchanges to purchase their own personal health care plans. Ezekiel Emanuel joins us. He's the former Obama administration advisor on health care and chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Mr. Emanuel, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So what is the incentive here for the private sector to get on board?
Well, they want to keep health care costs down. They need to have a system that works efficiently so that they can concentrate on their major activity, which is either selling drugs in the case of Walgreens or in other for other companies, other things. And they would like their workforce to be healthy, but not to have to worry year in and year out about healthcare costs affecting their bottom line.
So is Walgreens and are other companies able to basically farm out some of their employee-related healthcare costs by joining the exchanges? Is there an economic benefit for Walgreens?
Well, let's be clear. First of all, this is a private exchange, not the public exchanges that everyone's talking about to be opened on October 1st, where people can buy insurance. This is an exchange set up by a consulting company for Walgreens using a lot of insurer bids. These are becoming more common. My own view, but this is speculation, is that they're trying to socialize their workers and retirees to the fact that they'll be able to purchase insurance in an exchange. And if the public exchanges work well and are stable and have a good selection, I think in the future they'll probably consider moving their people from their private exchange into the public exchange. That's my suspicion. At the moment, I think it's also a way of them limiting their exposure, just like companies went from pension plans to 401ks to limit how much they were exposed and what the rate increases over time would be. Similarly, in the healthcare field, they're going to have a defined contribution. They're going to give a set amount of money to people and let them shop. If they want more expensive healthcare, they'll have to pay the difference.
All right, Ezekiel Emanuel, let me have you decode a statement we got here at the Takeaway from Walgreens. They said, by moving to a corporate exchange, we are able to provide our employees with as many as 25 different health insurance options at a range of costs. It's important to have a variety of options available to our employees so that they can choose one that best meets their particular needs. Now, they're calling this an upgrade. From the standpoint of a worker, are they going to view this as an upgrade?
I think it really depends on the worker and their circumstances, but in general, probably in the first year, it will just enhance their choices. Beyond that, the real question is, what is the rate of increase of that defined contribution? So if Walgreens says, oh, we're going to pay $5,000 this year, and by the way, next year it's going to go up at the rate of underlying inflation, not healthcare inflation, they will progressively be losing money. And then it won't be so much in their advantage. They'll have to be spending more. And that's the key question. And that's something to look at year on year. Let me say one other thing. You know,
sure.
Walgreens said a lot of this is a result of going to the because of the Affordable Care Act, et cetera. I don't understand that. You know, we've got thousands of large companies like Walgreens, from General Electric to Intel to Cisco, and only a handful like Walgreens are actually doing anything like these internal private exchanges. If it were forced on them because of the Affordable Care Act, you would think that almost all the big companies would be doing this. So that's, I think, a little bit of a window dressing.
But help us to understand this argument, and bearing in mind that you are a former Obama administration official, you know, the conservatives and the people in Congress who are against Obamacare always talk about the Affordable Care Act as being a tax on business. What do they mean by that? And is this Walgreens action a sign that Walgreens believes that?
No. I don't understand what it means as being a tax on business. Most of these large corporations like Walgreens are already providing health care. They aren't doing they weren't forced to do anything differently. And if anything, if Walgreens' move shows anything, they actually have more flexibility under the Affordable Care Act to approach their health care benefit situation in a variety of different ways. So that's just another smokescreen about the Affordable Care Act. It's not a tax at all on businesses. Again, most companies over 200 employees, not just a little, 99% of companies with over 200 employees already offer health insurance. There's no such thing as a tax in there for these companies.
Ezekiel Emanuel is a former Obama administration advisor on health care. He's chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nobody got it right yesterday. Ben Bernanke's little Wednesday afternoon bombshell.
The committee decided today to keep the target range for the federal funds rate at 0 to 1/4%, and to make no change in either its asset purchase program or its forward guidance regarding the federal funds rate target.
The Federal Reserve voted 9-1 to maintain what Fed Chair Ben Bernanke calls there the asset purchase program. It's also known as the stimulus or quantitative easing. It means that the central bank will continue to support the economy by buying $45 billion in bonds each month and $40 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. The program began under Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke in 2008, and virtually every observer believed that Bernanke would announce a gradual reduction yesterday in the purchases, with the intent of ending them entirely by the middle of next year. The surprise pushed global markets into the stratosphere in a now typical short-term reaction. But what's the long game here? Joining us now is Sheila Bair. Ms. Bair was the chairwoman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation from 2006 to 2011 and is the author of Bull by the Horns, Fighting to Save Main Street from Wall Street and Wall Street from Itself. Sheila Bair, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Let's talk about the sort of buried headline yesterday. Bernanke really was saying that the economy isn't doing as well as they had expected over at the Fed. He actually was predicting lower growth than he was saying just a few months ago.
Right. Well, it's ironic and a little bit self-contradictory. It's quantitative easing really isn't working, and it isn't really helping the economy. We've been doing this for several years now. They're approaching $4 trillion. Of these bonds on their balance sheets, and it's creating tremendous financial asset bubbles. The bond and stock markets are both inflated, in my view. But in terms of promoting real economic growth, we're just not seeing it.
And in terms of Bernanke's legacy, I mean, he's out in January. By not doing anything yesterday, he's essentially left this really to the next chairman of the Fed, or chairwoman of the Fed, if it's Janet Yellen. This won't even begin under his tenure necessarily.
Well, no, it won't. It surprises me because I think the longer they stay in, the more difficult it is to get out. And again, I don't think it's helping. It's a little, you know, instead of taking the punch bowl away, they just poured a little more liquor into it. So that's not really something that's going to be sustainable. And we need to get the Fed out of these tremendous intrusions into the markets. Let the economy find its equilibrium. Let's find out how healthy it really is. It would be nice if Congress got its act together and had some fiscal programs like long-term infrastructure spending, fundamental reform of the tax code. Those would be the kinds of things that I think would be stimulative of real economic growth.
Congress, of course, is already causing huge headaches, and Bernanke spent a bunch of time yesterday even talking about what we've already discussed on this program. I mean, can the economy sustain an $85 billion a month drug rehab program, basically a kind of a shock treatment?
It's true. It's a good analogy. I've used it before. It is an addiction. Look, we have no idea where the tentacles of this thing have gone. They need to get out. They need to start getting out. They need to go very slowly. Esther George, the head of the Kansas City Fed, the one dissenting vote, had suggested that they believe publicly that they start with $15 billion. So take it down to 70 from 85. Do that for a while, then ratchet it down a little bit again, but get out. I'm seeing a lot of what I saw, or hearing about a lot of what I saw and witnessed in the lead up to the subprime crisis. When you keep interest rates on safe assets low for this long, lenders, investors go out for yield. They reach for yield, and they take more risk by reaching for yield. And that's exactly the dynamic we had leading up to the subprime crisis. And I fear now we have the same problem, except this time the bubble's in financial assets. It's not in housing.
If we look globally, is this a program that is helping Europe get through its problems, helping Japan come out of its recession, even though the U.S. economy may pay the price later on?
I don't know. I think long term it doesn't help anyone. You know, just printing paper it is not real economic growth. History has shown the only thing that's real sustainable economic growth is that you actually produce real goods and services that other people find of value and are willing to purchase. Just, you know, the Federal Reserve banks or central banks throughout the world pumping in more cash into the system, you get some short-term pop, and certainly it was needed and justified in 2008 and 2009 to compensate for some of the other things that were going on, but then get out. The economy can't find its equilibrium. It can't find its footing if it's constantly on this drug. I think the addiction analogy is a good one. You feel good about it for a while when you're on a narcotic, but it's actually making your underlying health situation worse.
Let's talk in economic history terms, and you really witnessed a lot of very important economic history during your time at the FDIC. I'm wondering, have we passed the point where Bernanke's legacy, and really did we pass that point yesterday, where the legacy of Bernanke is avoiding catastrophe, and now we're really looking at that's over with, and we've really created a potential new catastrophe from this point on?
Well, it could be. I think history will tell. We just don't know if they're going to be able to exit in a way that's going to avoid market disruptions and another downturn. But again, the sooner they start and go slow, go gradually, but go predictably, the better off they will be. I think Ben will always be favorably remembered as one who avoided a Great Depression. He didn't repeat the mistakes that the Fed made at the onset of the Great Depression by tightening credit conditions. He opened up the spigot wide. That was a good thing to do in 2008 and 2009. But I think now he's making new mistakes by letting this go on far too long. So he avoided a Great Depression. History will always treat him well for this. You know, the legacy of these pronounced and prolonged bond purchases, I think the jury is very much out, and only history will tell whether we can actually exit out of this or not.
Talking with Sheila Bair, chairwoman of the FDIC from 2006 to 2011. This is The Takeaway. Let's leave everyone on a positive note, if we could. Who does this benefit, even if it's just short term?
Well, unfortunately, you know, the top 10% of the population owns the vast majority of financial assets, stocks and bonds. So they have been the primary beneficiaries, unfortunately, of this Fed quantitative easing. But keeping interest rates low a little longer should keep mortgage rates down. They've already gone down a bit. So if you're in there wanting to buy a house, now's probably a good time because at some point they are going to go back up.
So the Federal Reserve has its asset purchase program, and it may enable some homeowners to purchase some assets, at least between now and sometime next year. Sheila Bair, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Sheila Bair is former FDIC chairwoman from 2006 to 2011, author of Bull by the Horns, Fighting to Save Main Street from Wall Street. Later this hour, we'll hear from a defiant state senator, John Morse, now ousted Colorado Senate president, who was kicked out of office for his support for more restrictive gun control laws. And this week's tragedy in D.C. seems only to have strengthened his resolve.
There are 12 families in the Washington, D.C. area that are going to be going to funerals. And so their right to live has been extinguished in favor of someone else's right to misinterpret the Second Amendment.
More from Colorado's outgoing Senate president this hour. And with Starbucks announcing that firearms are no longer welcome in their stores, we're asking you for your view. Do you agree with Starbucks' decision? Visit our website at thetakeaway.org to take part in our poll.
The end of the world is coming.
It was predicted thousands of years ago.
See ya!
A reverse polarity sunspot.
Goodbye.
There is no such thing as death. Life is only a dream.
This is the end.
Now, folks, I don't want to disrupt your day at all, but I want to assure you that if for some reason, not saying it's going to happen, but just if somehow all of civilization was wiped out and all that was left was a few isolated bands of survivors wandering around looking for canned goods or the occasional non-radioactive rabbit for dinner, if this happened, I want to assure you that the instructions for rebuilding society are intact. The instructions for reestablishing human civilization survived the deluge. You don't have to worry about that. If you happen to be down here in Georgia, you may even know where they can be found. Just off Route 72, inscribed in indestructible 19-foot slabs of granite, humanity's cheat sheet for restoring an age of reason.
Protect people and nations with fair laws and just courts.
Maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature.
Protect people and nations with fair laws and just courts.
Avoid petty laws and useless officials.
Balance personal rights with social duties.
That's some of the wisdom inscribed on the Georgia Guidestones. Endowed by an anonymous donor, the Guidestones were engraved with this wisdom in 8 languages, erected and finished back in 1980. Mart Clamp is a local businessman who helped his father engrave the Guidestones, and he drove all the way up to Atlanta from Elberton, an hour and a half from where we are right now, to be with us. Welcome.
How are you?
Great. You know, is the fact that you drove all the way up here a sense of the urgency of these Guidestones that, we need to know about this?
Well, my interest in the Guidestones is purely economic. Elberton, Georgia sits in a economically depressed area of the state. We have 12-13% unemployment, and we'd like to start some tourism and get folks interested in coming and seeing it.
Now, your dad was a stonemason,
that's
right,
correct,
who helped to erect it. What was the idea at the time? Did your dad tell you what was going on, who the anonymous donor was? You don't have to give anything away.
But Right. There's only two individuals who actually knew who the man was. He went by the pseudonym of R.C. Christian. My father was approached by the Elberton Granite Association to do the engraving. He had a portable sandblasting machine at the time. He was capable of doing the size work that needed to be done.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the wisdom that's on the, that your dad helped to engrave. Guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity, unite humanity with a living new language, maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. Well, we blew that one. where did the wisdom come from? Do you know? This is not biblically based necessarily.
You know, it's not biblically based. It doesn't mean it's anti-Christian. But I think this is just R.C. Christian's view of how we should live our lives.
Avoid petty laws and useless officials. You know, that's a useful idea for right now.
Right,
forget
right.
The end times. Let's put that one into effect right today.
Exactly.
So what do people think of when they come to Elberton and ask, what the heck is that over there?
The people that come and see it are just amazed by it. So it's self-promoting. We don't have to do anything. And I think that has a lot to do with the controversy around it. You know, who is R.C. Christian? Who are the people who built this and why? What we as Elbert County citizens want to do is find a way to make money off of that and promote it in a positive way. A lot of the videos on YouTube are speculative. They tend to just come up with anything from the alien theory to, you know, whatever.
And it was UFOs, right?
Yeah, sure it was.
Yeah. Okay.
But we want to put a visitor center in, make a festival around it. That's my idea.
It's kind of a cross between Area 51 and Stonehenge.
Absolutely.
That's a pretty good combo. Mark Clamp from Elberton, Georgia, thanks so much.
Appreciate you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Next week could open a historic chapter in the history of the United States and Iran. There are tentative signs of a possible sea change in Iran with newly elected Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. He's visiting New York next week for the United Nations General Assembly. And there's been the release of 11 political prisoners this week. Rouhani sent Rosh Hashanah greetings to Jews worldwide. And there's been a promise that the country will never seek a nuclear bomb. At the core of the diplomacy is a series of letters exchanged between President Obama and President Rouhani. And President Rouhani even referred to this sea change and the signs of hope in an interview yesterday with NBC News.
It could be subtle and tiny steps for a very important future.
What is going on here? Joining us now, Thomas Erbrink, Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Is there a palpable sense, Thomas, that things are on the verge of some change?
Well, here in Tehran, that is definitely the case, because not only has President Rouhani answered those letters from President Obama, he has sent out his tweets to the Jews, and he has appointed several technocrats that all are educated in the United States. Also, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has clearly given the green light for talks with the United States. He recently spoke of flexibility being a necessity in diplomacy. And many analysts here interpret that as him saying to Rouhani, go ahead, talk to our previously eternal enemy, the United States.
We also learned that Rouhani apparently intends to visit an exhibit in Manhattan when he's in New York that we focused on the program that's all about the period of the Shah just before the revolution, something you would never have expected an Ahmadinejad, for instance, to do. Does that have meaning? Is that well known in Tehran?
Well, in all honesty, I don't know the exact details of Mr. Rouhani's program in New York, but what is clear is that he has led a diplomatic effort over the past month trying to persuade the American audience, the American decision makers, into believing that he is really a representative of a new and moderate Iran, an Iran that is ready to deal with the world and, more importantly, for the first time in 34 years, to talk to the United States to solve outstanding issues. And the main outstanding issue is, of course, the nuclear program that Iran and the United States have been bickering over for the past 10 years.
Well, it's one thing to represent a very different personal style than his predecessor, President Ahmadinejad, but it's quite another to really position Iran to have a fundamentally different kind of relationship with the United States. Is some of the skepticism in the West well-founded?
Well, I think Iranian policy is always two-sided. Naturally, people can be skeptical when they see this cleric, smiling cleric in clerical robes who promises better relations with the West. And of course, there are a lot of buts and ifs in his words. He's expecting also the West to reach out to him. But the big, big difference is that this time, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, is on board. And this is what Mr. Rouhani very clearly said yesterday in the interview with NBC. He said, I am coming to New York to negotiate under the full authority of our supreme leader. Now, that is a real break with the past, and that shows that Iran's conservative top leader is actually sending Mr. Rouhani as his representative to talk to the United States, and that is the sea change here.
And we'll see what can happen, because potentially it could have implications for the Iranian nuclear program and everything, including the Syrian civil war. We'll see what can be accomplished next week in New York. Thomas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Erdbrink is the Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
At a certain point in a democracy, you just have to conclude that the people have spoken. The death of 12 people this week at the hands of a gun-toting, possibly mentally disturbed man at the Washington Navy Yard seems to be another case of, here we go again.
I do get concerned that this becomes a ritual that we go through every 3-4 months, where we have these horrific mass shootings, and yet we're not willing to take some basic actions that we know can make a difference.
The president expressing his frustration in remarks to the Telemundo network yesterday. Is it just a pattern, some impassioned talk about tragedy and the need to reduce gun violence, but in the end, no political will to make substantive changes in laws that make guns widely available in the United States? Either the people don't want to significantly change gun laws, or gun safety preferences of Americans are being thwarted by some astute pro-gun activists and organizations, principally the NRA. In Colorado, it may be both. After the shooting rampage at the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper got a majority of lawmakers to enact some tough gun control measures, including a ban on high-capacity magazines and mandatory universal background checks. But in a recall election last week, Colorado voters punished two Democratic legislators for their support of those laws. Colorado Senate President John Morse from the conservative Colorado Springs area was ousted. In his Senate district, technically, the people may have spoken on gun control, but Morse is not liking what he's hearing.
The things that we did were so common sense. I mean, you got to reload after cranking out 15 rounds. You got to get a background check before you buy a gun. You got to pay for that background check yourself. The taxpayers aren't going to do it for you. If you want a concealed weapons permit, the training that you need for that has got to be in person, not over the internet. And then the fifth thing that we did concerned domestic violence and made sure that judges could secure the guns in those situations if they needed to. So again, there's nothing here that's earth-shattering. And my district has the census tract within it, within Colorado, that had the most number of gun deaths in the last 10 years of any, again, anywhere in the state. It's right in my district in Colorado Springs, Colorado. So 80% of the folks around the country agree with the things that we did. But obviously, the politicians are not getting in front of that parade. For whatever reason, they're cowering in the bushes along the parade route.
Well, they're cowering because, you know, your picture is on the poster of what can happen to you if you defy the NRA. But let's just look at the political disconnect here. I mean, I think there is evidence, and I think post-Newtown, you're really seeing evidence that there is a real legitimate political disconnect between the idea of these automatic weapons and assault weapons as being something for hobbyists and the question of crime and gun violence, which I think people oppose and are outraged by, but they don't think that these reform measures necessarily address the question of gun violence. That's starting to be pretty well proven in the political outcomes we've seen.
You're right. My picture is where it shouldn't be. But at the same time, the facts don't support what you just said. The beliefs do. But the facts don't. We know when there are background checks, there are fewer homicides, fewer suicides, fewer accidental shootings. We know it's a good idea. We know it works. We know it reduces gun violence. Now, getting that message out, and you know, John F. Kennedy suggested that, you know, there's nothing so powerful as the lie except the myth. You know, they're so much harder to correct, if you will. And so that's sort of where we are, in my view, from a political perspective, is we've got to get people to understand, no, these laws will work if we just give them a chance.
Well, you don't need to convince me, but certainly, as your experience suggests, the myth, as you describe it, is winning politically. And if a former police chief can't get that message out, it really doesn't give a lot of hope for the Harry Reids of the world in the U.S. Senate. Let's talk for a minute about the D.C. shooter this week. What law, regulation could you come up with that would have prevented a former Navy veteran from carrying a weapon into a secure naval facility and start shooting?
And again, you know, it's still early in the process to where we don't know all the facts and what really went on here. But obviously, you know, the background check system would have worked in this case if it was robust enough. And we all acknowledge that, you know, we've got to get better at putting convictions in there. We've got to think about arrests from a public safety perspective. I mean, people are certainly entitled to the presumption of innocence to a point, and then all the mental health issues and whatnot as well. You know, we've got to get so much better at being able to figure out when someone is dangerously mentally ill instead of just mentally ill.
All right, but Senator Morse, let me just push you on this. What law, what regulation would catch in a background check someone being treated by the VA for a sleep disorder, who was honorably discharged from the Navy and had a little history of rage?
Well, and a history of firing off a gun when it was completely and totally inappropriate.
He's in the Navy. People in the Navy fire guns.
No. Well, no, but they don't fire them in their own homes, going through the ceiling above them with someone that's been making more noise than they want them to, even if you then claim that it was an accidental kind of thing. It's like, well, if you have those kinds of accidents with guns, you know, again, right now our background check system is not robust enough to evaluate that, and I would argue that it needs to be.
Can you monitor those kinds of details in the lives of Americans without getting the NSA surveillance involved?
And that's a great point. And it is a balancing test here that we need to do, but there are 12 families in the Washington, D.C. area that are going to be going to funerals. And so their right to live has been extinguished in favor of someone else's right to misinterpret the Second Amendment. So
and
I think
tomorrow Rush Limbaugh is going to say that this former state senator John Morris is using the death of those families to advance his political career, and some Americans are going to buy it.
Sure they are, but they're not going to recognize that his political career is already over. And what we're talking about is what's really going on in America, and the calls by Mr. Limbaugh and others to just have a moment of silence that lasts for decades is resulting in unnecessary deaths.
Well, State Senator John Morse, I appreciate your candor. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
John Morse, Colorado Senate President, recalled because of his votes on gun control legislation.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Back to healthcare now. So to support your health, you take a yoga class. I bet some of you do, with a dozen other people. Maybe you do some healthy exercise in a group with a trainer urging you on and your fellow classmates keeping up your morale. Maybe you even compare your stamina to the slightly chubbier person there in front of you.
Let's begin with a great warm-up. Take a deep breath in, bring in that oxygen, and let out any stress you may have. Another deep breath for energy.
Well, what if this group idea that works in so many healthy endeavors was applied to a routine doctor checkup? The doctor, more like a trainer, examining patients in a group, leading a group discussion of symptoms, sharing advice on treatment, and staying on track toward personal health goals, huh? Well, in the changing healthcare industry, this model is becoming attractive to some doctors and patients. Aside from the efficiency of treating patients in a group, there are other subtler advantages to group thinking the traditional doctor visit. Today, 13% of medical practices, in fact, have the option of group doctor visits. Dr. Alexander Kuo is among them. He's a professor of medicine and director of hepatology at the University of California, San Diego. He uses the group visit method with his transplant patients at the UC San Diego clinic. Doctor, welcome.
Hello, good to be with you.
So, first of all, just separate the population of transplant patients from people going in for more routine checkups. I mean, is there something about the transplant experience that lends itself to the group? And is it not really applicable to, say, me going into my regular checkup?
Sure. You know, when I started this about a year ago, I really wanted to focus on patients with advanced liver disease. And so these are patients that have cirrhosis who are either on the waiting list for transplant or they're considering being placed on the waiting list for transplant. And what I found was that these patients really had a lack of information. And the standard 20-minute one-on-one doctor visit with me just wasn't enough for these patients. They needed more time with me. I needed more time to educate them. And this was an attractive option.
And I've seen group activity benefit cardiac transplant patients, actually in New York at the Mount Sinai Transplant Clinic. But how would this work if people are coming in for more routine examinations, do you think?
Well, I think this can really work for any medical condition. We've chosen to focus this on patients with advanced liver disease. But in any situation where patients are really eager to get more information and more time with their doctor, this system can work. In general, I think it works best if you can group patients together with similar diagnoses. And so when they're there in the group, you know, not only are they learning from the doctor's one-on-one interaction with them, but they're learning by listening to the questions that other patients in the group have. They might have thought of questions that that you might have not even thought about yourself.
And what are some of the limitations here? I mean, obviously, you're not doing boys and girls together. And I mean, I just describe to me what the limits are as you see them.
Sure, sure. So one misconception is that you know, everybody's sitting together in a circle in a hospital exam gown. That's not the case in my situation. And so the patients are fully clothed. I will do targeted physical exams in the group setting. And so listening to breathing, palpate the abdomen, examine the legs for a swelling, edema. But I don't disrobe the patients. If patients need more focused, more extensive physical exams, I wait until after the group session is over and I take them to a standard private examination room for that. And so, you know, there is that concern about embarrassment in front of other people if you're going to be examined. But you know, patients are fully clothed.
And it's your experience that patients take to this group thing and actually, you know, cease being embarrassed or uncomfortable about something that would normally be a very private one-on-one experience.
You know, they do. It's not for everybody, I would say that. If you're extremely bashful, if you're somewhat of a wallflower, it might not be your cup of tea. On the other hand, if you're very domineering, if you tend to sort of dominate every conversation and not let anybody have a word edgewise, that's not really fair to the other patients, and that might not be the best situation for you as well. But those are really the extremes. For the most part, I would say 80 to 90% of patients in my practice would be really appropriate for this type of a group visit.
All right. Well, as some of your patients or patients considering this might be inclined to do, we consulted a lawyer to figure out what the questions would be here regarding privacy issues. Here's a comment and a question and an issue actually raised by Robbie M.A. Sufi, a lawyer talking about medical privacy. Listen.
Whether it's HIPAA or state laws, the rules and regulations that govern how patient health information is supposed to be maintained are very strict. The problem in a group setting is that those same rules that govern how patient health information is supposed to be stored and transmitted and maintained do not apply to individuals. They apply to healthcare providers.
So is that a limitation for you to do something that actually seems to make some good sense?
Well, first off, this is optional for my patients. I'm not forcing them to participate in this. For me, this is a value added. Instead of a 20-minute visit, they get a 90-minute visit with me. The patients have the option to bring one guest. Both patients and their guests have to sign privacy waivers stating that everything discussed at that group visit will remain confidential. And so if patients enjoy that visit, they can elect to go back to the standard one-on-one interaction with me.
And we're talking with Dr. Alexander Kuo, who's a professor of medicine and director of hepatology at the University of California, San Diego, who uses group visit methods for some of the patients in his practice. I can see the efficiencies for you getting maximum time with patients, but public health you know, doctors often describe that the health is improved if people can think of health in community settings, in groups, in family-wide or neighborhood-wide settings. Do you think this contributes to that at all?
Absolutely. You know, the feedback I get from patients often is that, you know, they feel like they're part of a community, that they don't feel alone. When you're diagnosed with advanced liver disease, it can really feel isolating. It's scary to be told that you have cirrhosis and you need a liver transplant. And by bringing patients with similar problems together, they really feel empowered. And so I do feel that sense of community helps with their healing.
Great. Thanks so much. Dr. Alexander Kuo is a professor of medicine and director of hepatology at the University of California, San Diego. Thanks, doctor.
Thank you.
And before we leave you today, listen to that. It's the sound of a bike harp from a repurposed bicycle frame, handlebars making the sounds of flutes and horns, and a Schwinn three-speed cruiser flipped upside down to become a drum set.
I mean, when I look at an old bicycle, it's like, that's an instrument. That's not a bike anymore.
Tomorrow, bicycles built for two musicians who use them to make beautiful sounds, the soundtrack for our Takeaway Bike Challenge. We're asking you to submit a haiku about your bike riding experience. Can you do better than any of these?
Flat tires, dusty seat, sitting in the dark corner. Will I ride today?
Hugging Hudson's shore, pedaling, gliding, flying, peace from river strength.
Stationary bike takes me everywhere I go. Still wear a helmet.
Hey, to submit your baiku, visit our website at thetakeaway.org. Submissions being accepted until 11:59 Eastern on Sunday, September 22nd. We have three judges to pick their 10 favorites, and the winners get Takeaway bike helmets. Now that's real value. Thanks so much for listening. All the rules at our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry in the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'll be back in New York tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.